You're listening to episode 94 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
What's up, Storyteller Tribe? As you might have heard in recent episodes, I am totally geeking out about having Overdrive as a sponsor. I've been a fan of theirs for 6 years, and I'm so honored to share the exciting news about their brand new app called Libby. It's designed for readers to discover and enjoy ebooks and audiobooks from your library. I have way more amazing details to share with you, so please be sure to hang around at the end of the show. I'd also love to wish Judalyn Smith from our community a very happy birthday. May all of your dreams and wishes come true. We have Zoraida Cordova in today's new episode. Zoraida is the author of the Vicious Deep Trilogy, the On the Verge series, and the Brooklyn Brujas series. Her latest novel, Labyrinth Lost, was a Tor.com Best Book of 2016 and an NPR Best Young Adult Book of 2016. It was also optioned for film by Paramount Studios. In today's episode, Zoraida walks us through the inspiration behind Labyrinth Lost and how she created the religion in the novel. She also shares how the editing journey for her novel inspired new storylines and stronger characters, and what it was like to land the movie deal. Further into our conversation, we talk about the importance of surrounding yourself with honest people in the writing community who push you to do better. For craft-focused listeners, we discuss how your own family structure can inspire world-building ideas and why Zoraida doesn't always rationalize the character's emotions. Just a heads up, our conversation was recorded back in mid-June, and there's an exciting announcement shared in our chat, which you may have already heard about by now. Either way, keep an ear out for it. Now let's dive right in.
Zoraida, how are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
I am so excited. I'm just going to let the listeners know I sound so out of breath because the Wi-Fi totally got cut out on my end. And Zoraida was awesome and patient and put up with it and has hung out with us for half an hour before waiting for my ass getting the Wi-Fi fixed. So thank you. We are even more appreciative of you. Zoraida, I know we were just talking about what you're busy doing. So I would love for the listeners to know what you're getting ready for. Where are you headed to?
I'm headed to Vermont. I'm doing the Long Trail. The southern terminus is at the border of Vermont and Massachusetts. And it goes from there to the border of Canada. It's not the actual Canada border. It's you graze, you wave to Canada. And then it loops back down around 2 more miles because you can't actually cross. I was really inspired after I read and saw Wild. After that, last year, I started doing all of these nature things with my cousin. And so from then on, every summer, it's only the second summer, so I'm saying every summer. This is our second summer doing a big trip. Last year, we did camping through every New England town that we could find. We just went on like a 3-week road trip all the way up to Maine. And stopped along the way. We didn't even plan ahead. We would plan 2 days ahead. So when we were in one town, I would reserve the campsites for the next place. We stopped in Portland, Maine, and we got an Airbnb. And it was amazing. It was just so much fun.
Oh my gosh, Zoraida, that's totally my style of traveling. I love that. There's something about it being so spontaneous and not planning too far ahead. I think there's something really special about that. And it really also shows you how you handle things very last minute, and it says a lot about you as a person and how you grow. I mean, you're saying it's like the second time, but even then it's so much growth since when you first started.
Especially this time it's going to be because it's through hiking, so you carry everything that you need on your back. For me, I've had like a really busy year since Labyrinth Lost came out, since the announcement of the movie stuff, and I'm working on all these other projects. I feel like I just haven't really had a chance to breathe. And so this trip for me is a really big symbol of getting rid of excess things and going out into essentially the wilderness, because it is the Vermont wilderness.
Getting back to the core, stillness and groundedness. Yeah. I would always rely on camping when my life was insane when I was younger.
That's so cool.
And I would always do camping because that's what grounded me. I would get really lost in whether it was working or work-related events. And I needed to get out into nature just to get back to myself and not get confused with my priorities in a way. So nature really has something about that that really just makes makes you recognize and realize, okay, we're just this tiny little speck in the world. So all these issues that we think we might have is really not a big deal. There's something so meditative about it.
Yeah. And then your issues become so different. What am I going to eat? Where am I going to get my water source? It's all in the map. But at the same time, it's scary. What if the water source runs dry? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a much problem in Vermont where it rains 40 inches for the summer. I'm working my way up to eventually one day do the Pacific Crest Trail. So that's my goal.
Have you gone to Pacific Northwest?
No. I would love to.
Girl, you need to go. Please make that your goal next year. It is beautiful. I didn't get to hike along the Pacific Northwest. My girlfriend and I did a road trip. We actually flew into Vancouver, then drove down all the way to the very tip-top bottom of, I think it was Bend, Oregon, or was it Ashland, Oregon, there.
Ashland is a really popular stopping ground.
That was definitely one of them. And I also stopped by Bend, but then I looped back up. Then we drove right back up in a circle back up to Vancouver, and we got to check out Crater Lake. We stopped by a lot of beautiful areas. It was just breathtaking. It was probably the best road trip I've been on, especially in terms in regards to scenery. I'm so excited for you. You mentioned before we started recording that you're looking for a place to stay every other day. So does that mean you're driving to a spot first, then getting out of the car, then hiking all the way?
What we're doing is we're taking a bus from Penn Station in New York to a town called, it's either Williamson or Williamstown, because everything in Massachusetts is pronounced differently than it's spelled. So it's probably Williamstown, and it's at the very, very border of Vermont and Massachusetts. And so from there, the trail is only 2 miles. It's the Appalachian Trail. We hop on that, and that leads into the Vermont Trail. And so we're not driving at all. We're just walking. This is the first time I've ever done it. I've been preparing myself. I live on the Upper East Side, and there's really not a lot of nature here. I have those 5-pound weights. I put 10-pound weights in my backpack with some clothes, and then I just walk around the city. And that's really the only way to train. It's going to be harder because there's mountains. I've been looking at pictures just for motivation, and it's so beautiful.
How long are you giving yourself for this hike?
We're doing 25 days.
Damn. Oh my gosh. I always wanted to do one of these hikes, like a super long hike.
Yeah.
I had a friend, her ex-boyfriend, he went on this trail in Spain.
I know which one you're talking about. Camino de Santiago.
That's the one.
It's 1,000 miles.
When he told us about it, I was so excited, so inspired, and I wanted to do something like that.
You're in California, right?
I actually am back home in New York currently to visit family. Oh. I still happen to be in New York for these several weeks. I had a bachelorette party to attend, and then BookCon, and then checking out some work-related things for the podcast. And then we're heading back to Vancouver for the bachelorette girls' wedding.
Nice.
Then back down to California. My God, I'm so excited for you, because I'm going to check out this trail that you're going to do. I hope I could do that one day. Are you prepared if anything happens, like a knee brace?
I have a knee wrap. And I have wrist braces too. Sometimes I use wrist braces when I write. If you fall, and it's instinctive, I can't mess up my hands. It's basically preparing for worst case scenario. That's what I'm up to right now. I have gear. It's just a matter of, what if something goes wrong? What if you get like a giant cut? What if there's, you know, like animals? Yes. Like, I know that we can do it. And I've been following people on Instagram. They're doing the Pacific Crest Trail right now, and they're hashtag PCT 2017. Even though they're on the West Coast, it's still really inspiring to see them. They're in the desert. Mojave.
Yeah.
And so they're doing that trail so much harder. At least in Vermont, you have plenty of water sources.
I was wondering, like, how are they carrying all that water throughout the desert? Portion it out and then wait for the next stop to refill their bottles?
That's exactly it. They're water bladders, so they're really hard bags of water. It's a harder plastic. It's 3 liters, and you carry that in your backpack. At least that's what I've seen most people.
I feel like 3 liters is not enough. I mean, for the desert, hell no. I'd be like a water buffalo. I'm like, where is my 3 gallons? I cannot be doing this right now. We are going to talk about your books, and we are going to talk about you as an author, but this is awesome because they get to see you as a human being, which is so cool that you make time for this. People saying if they can't have time to balance certain things, like, there's no excuse. You're doing it.
No, I have to do it. I have to take time off. I've already emailed everybody.
Please make sure to bring Neosporin, Band-Aids.
I'm bringing bear spray.
Bear spray, bug spray. I don't even know if you want those walking sticks, because I think those are like collapsible too.
The trekking poles. Yeah. Yes, I'm about to order a pair just in case.
All right. Sorry. That was my mama bear coming out. I'm like, Thank you. Just in case.
No, I appreciate it.
Are you going to be updating your social media with photos?
I will. It's like I'm a live check-in.
Okay, good, good.
Hi, guys. I'm still surviving.
Perfect. Okay, good. So at least I want the listeners to know that, so they can check you out and follow you and your journey, so they could feel inspired too.
Oh, thank you.
You should totally reach out to Cheryl Strayed and let her know that she's made such a huge impact on you. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, hello. Thank you for sharing that. And I totally have to do that one day. You were mentioning that it's been like super crazy because you're wrapping up for your huge, massive hiking trip. You mentioned also a movie deal. Let's get into that. Whatever you can share, do you mind sharing?
Yeah, absolutely. So a little bit last year in November, we got a call from Paramount saying that they wanted to option Labyrinth Lost. It felt like such a serendipitous moment because the Paramount person had read my book, I think through NPR or something like that. And then she really loved it. For me, I was like, you know, when does that happen? It just felt so many things had to coincide. That sounds really woo-woo, but...
No. I'm all about that. I believe in that. Yeah. I totally get it.
It just felt everything was coming together at this right moment. We have this deal with Paramount. I'm really trusting them. We had this really amazing conversation about what they see in the book and the journey that Alex goes through. And they love that it's a Latinx story. I feel very confident in them.
Wow.
And in their ability to translate this. Right now, they're still looking for screenwriters. So they basically update me as they go along, but authors don't really have any input in a lot of the things. And casting and stuff like that. But I'm just excited to be able to see what's going to happen.
Oh, hell yeah. Well, first off, congratulations, man.
Thank you. Paramount
freaking reached out. We've had authors on the show that have mentioned that it's true. Once they sell the rights for movies or TV shows to be made, that they don't really have a say in it. But they're so excited to have their story passed on. You've done your deed where you put it out in the world and it's how the world accepts it and how what they want to do with it. In that case, when they approached you, do they hit you up and trying to convince you to trust in them and sell them the rights? Do they hit you up with almost like, I would think like a visual board to show you what they want to do with your story?
It was just a matter of connect with the people that are going to be handling putting everything together. Right now, they don't have a directors or producers attached. So all of that storyboarding stuff, I think that the directors or producers bring that to the table when they're being selected. That's what I've been told from other people's experiences. For me, it was just having them talk to me in a way that felt really relatable, knowing that it might be a huge movie studio, but the people that are working there, they're real people too. I'm really excited.
That is so awesome. And in those cases, are you able to ask to be a screenwriter, or is that something that you don't want to deal with? I know some authors would rather just stick with writing books because they're saying that writing scripts, which is true, is another beast in itself.
It's a completely other beast. And I think that one day I would love to write screenplays, but I don't think that I'm the best person to write the screenplay for Labyrinth Lost because I really love exposition and description. So I'm actually taking classes.
Nice.
So that one day I'll be able to write a screenplay that I'm really proud of. It's just so cool. It's a completely different medium. I think that you have to have really smart dialogue and it has to sound natural. I feel like I have that in my books, but it's different when it's on the screen. I'm pretty sure that I'm able to get a set visit. That's what I'm really excited about. It's just like watching everything.
They better be having you on the set. It's because of you. You're the mama. You're the creator. I mean, without you, there would be no movie set for it. That's
very
exciting.
True.
That is so exciting.
It's so exciting. That's what I'm really looking forward to. I think that I'm more calm about this than most writers would be. It's in somebody else's hands. But at the same time, I feel like I just understand that it's a different medium as long as you stay true to the heart of the story.
That is so exciting. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited for you. And there's a lot of listeners in our community who've read your book, Labyrinth Lost, and they love it. Would you mind giving those who may not have passed by your book just yet a screenshot of what it's about, Alex's story, and also your world building is incredible and beautiful.
Thank you.
So if you could please give a snapshot just from your own words, I'd love for them to hear.
Labyrinth Lost is about a girl named Alexandra Mortiz, and she is a bruja, which is the Spanish word for witch. She casts a curse to get rid of her power because her power burdens her, and she associates it with everything negative that's happened in her life. And so she casts this curse. It backfires, as things do when you've never practiced magic. And her entire family and her ancestors, essentially all the ghosts and the spirits of her ancestors, all get sent to another dimension where there's this evil witch called the Devourer who is going to literally devour their souls. And so now Alex is in the position of having to reclaim not just her destiny, but reclaim her, who she is as a witch, and put all that together and go into this other dimension called Los Lagos to get her family back. She's accompanied by a brujo named Nova and her best friend Rishi, who's human and not magical, but magical in different ways. So the three of them together, they're this like motley trio who, for the most part, they don't really get along, but they have to get along in order to survive across this land. And there are fairies and there are harpies and these demon beasts and a river made out of souls that burns when you touch it. And so they have a lot of challenges in the way. And so it's really just a journey of self-discovery and, most importantly, family.
I love that. Before we jump into the world building questions, I wanted to also note, especially because you said family, which is perfect leading it in, I really loved the highlight of the strength and connection between the women. I just always am curious about the author's stories and their own real life inspiration. How much of it was drawn from your real life? Were you very much raised in a matriarch type of family? And how was that like?
That's exactly how I was going to phrase it. I was going to phrase it as my own family is kind of a matriarchy. The head of our family is my grandmother, Alejandra. I named her after my grandmother, even though she goes by Alex. And every decision in the family goes to her, or like not even for approval, but just because we want.
Out of love and respect, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm Ecuadorian. It's cultural. You have to respect your elders. Mm-hmm. And I think that I put that in the construction of my witches and my brujas. I was also raised with a lot of men. I have my uncles, but at the same time, they didn't overshadow the women in my family. I should just feel really blessed to be able to put that into my story. It's funny because I didn't even notice that there were not that many guys in this book until somebody pointed it out to me.
I love it. It's a subconscious thing just totally coming out. Do you have siblings?
I have a little brother. Well, a little. He's 25. He's actually in the
living
room.
They'll always be little.
I know.
Well, hello to your brother.
We live together in the city. And so he moved in with me. He's a musician. He plays guitar
awesome.
And he sings. And he has a band called The Dreamland Fire.
Ooh, that sounds sexy.
It's really like Death Cab for Cutie, you know, like Dang. Angels and Airwaves kind of stuff. It was really chill. We're not in each other's space a lot. But at the same time, we get to talk about music and creating. And I think we understand each other at that
point. Yeah, definitely. You both are artists. So I think that's what helps. It's a lot easier to live artist to artist. And it's out like that, out of that respect. I think that's so awesome that you live with your brother. I'm from a very close-knit family and definitely matriarchs in this family. The men do not have a say at all. The women, if the men argue, it's all women against that one guy. It's
that's
game
so funny.
Over.
I love it.
Also, for me, coming from ethnic cultural background, we're very filial to our older relatives, too. And, and whatever grandpa or grandma says, it goes. It doesn't matter. Even if we're wrong, they are right. And it's just out of respect and out of love, too. I think you capture that so beautifully. And I'm very happy that our readers nowadays have that to understand how families are with their dynamics. And it's all different.
Yeah. And also, I think that no matter where you come from, even if you're not Latinx, you can identify with the idea of self-discovery and not really knowing who you are. Alex is 16. She doesn't know who she is. She has ideas of who she wants to be, but she can't figure that out if she rejects her family and rejects herself.
Yep.
And I think that everybody goes through a journey like that. There are very few people who are just like, I know exactly who I am and I'm super confident all the time.
Yeah, I agree. Have you known all your life that you wanted to be an author, or is this something?
I did.
You
did. When I was 9, when I first came to this country, I used to go back to Ecuador quite a bit every summer, but then I stopped. So when I was coming back, the flight attendants were so beautiful that I was like, I want to be a flight attendant because I associated it with beauty. That's like 9-year-olds write it. When I got into my teens, I wanted to be an archaeologist because I wanted to be Indiana Jones. But then I realized that, oh, I'm not going to be finding actual magical objects. People just dig up bones. Like, here's a piece of clay from 10,000 years ago, which is great, super cool for people who do it. We do read that research for when writers are creating. When I was 13, I read this book, In the Forest of the Night by Amelia Atwater Rhodes. And I completely fell in love with the idea of writing because she was 13 and I was 13. She got her first book published by Random House. It was a big deal back then. Like, it was like 1999 back then, all those years ago. So it was 1999. And I was like, I'm going to be a writer. When we talk about mirror images in media and in society, it's really important to be able to see a reflection of part of yourself. So Amelia Atwater Rhodes is not Latina. She's white. She's from Massachusetts. But she was still a 13-year-old girl who got this giant book deal. It was a major feat to be able to be published in a real space. And so being able to see that, I think that I was on a one-track mind. You couldn't tell me no. You couldn't tell me shit. That like, oh, you're not gonna make money. It's gonna be hard. And yeah, all of those things apply. But at the end of the day, the only thing I control are the words that I put on the page. And I think that all the hard work that I've done since my debut came out in 2012, all of that work is now paying off. Haters gonna hate.
You mentioned you totally had this one track mind. So we're talking about high school. You focus on creative writing classes. You laid your own path for yourself.
I did. I sought out these opportunities. I actually had a teacher, my social studies teacher, Mr. Johnson. He signed me up for the National Book Foundation writing camp. So the National Book Foundation, they used to have a writing camp and then they canceled it when the directors changed. The director took away the funding. He's not there anymore. It's a new woman. I was 16 and I got to have a workshop class with Jacqueline Woodson. Who am I?
Wow.
It was really beautiful. It was at Bennington College in Vermont. I think it was 7 days and it was 60 people from all ages. I'm still friends with some of the people that I went to camp with. We see each other grow in these spaces. And not everybody's a writer still, but they're still in this creative field. And so I bumped into that teacher, Mr. Johnson. I bumped into him in February on the subway.
What?
And I was like, yeah, I know. I was like, Mr. Johnson. And he recognized me. He knew that I was published, but he didn't know how many books I'd published. Then I told him about the movie deal and he was just so happy for me.
Oh my God.
It was just so nice. He got me started on this journey.
Exactly. It came full circle right there with Mr. Johnson bumping into him in February. That's insane.
It was just really wonderful to be able to do that.
I bet you totally made his whole year.
Yeah. He's actually retired, but he keeps track of a couple of his students. Sometimes, you know, you start doubting yourself. And it was this moment where my old mentor just sort of showed up again and reassured me that I was on the right track. I think that that fear never goes away, that fear of failure. And it actually heightens when you keep doing more stuff. Sorry for the writers out there who are listening to this.
No, but it's honesty and we appreciate it in this community for sure. Even to like tie along with that, Mr. Johnson, I'm sure, had lots of fears as well along his career and probably had some doubts. But then him planting the seeds and still staying true to his vision of wanting to inspire children and then bumping into you full circle like years after and hearing how well you did just from him encouraging you. Can you imagine what you did for him? What a gift it was to him. That was really touching.
Oh, thank you.
Congratulations on that. I think there's something really special about meeting up with the ones who originally basically inspired you to get into a certain career and then giving them thanks by doing well and really doing your best in what it is that you love to do. That's the best gift to give back.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts about being a writer and having a writing community is that I try to surround myself with people who are only going to push me to do better. I just did a writing retreat in Kansas last week and it was the best time because there were 9 of us in this house. And we hunkered down trying to get our word counts in. If you follow me on Instagram, you saw that we had like daily goals and everybody wrote down their goals of what they wanted to achieve for the day. We had a fellow writer, Natalie Parker. She would just like, Zoraida, how's your daily goal coming along? She didn't say it like that, but she kept us accountable and we kept each other accountable. And I think that now in a different stage of my career, I think that it's most important for me to surround myself with other writers who like are only going to make me better and just have honest friendships. You can talk about all the downs and you can talk about the ups.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important.
This is not the Madcap retreats, is it by any chance?
It wasn't an official Madcap, but it was some of the Madcap people.
Okay, gotcha. I know that we had a previous author on who was talking about Madcap, actually two of them that were mentioning the retreat and that it was a fantastic one. And also we have a lot of the listeners who were mentioning in the community, they've also mentioned that retreat. That's why I thought, because they also mentioned
Natalie.
Yeah, Natalie. That's why I'm like, oh, I wonder if it was tied close to that.
Yeah. Natalie Parker and Tessa Grattan, they run this retreat along with a couple of their friends, a couple of the other authors, and they have like a board, an administrative board, and then they put together writing retreats for aspiring authors. And they're really great. They have teachers like Leigh Bardugo and other authors like just come in and talk. I did a a workshop class with Gretchen McNeil, and we did a plotting session. So just like a new way to plot your book. And so that was really fun. And we're in the woods and we're all together and it's great.
That reminds me of this place I went to called Camp Grounded. I went twice. Mm. I went 3 years ago and then 2 years ago. Oh my gosh, it was so much fun. It wasn't writing focused. You're driving through Big Sur to get along. It's on the West Coast.
I've always wanted to drive.
Oh my God, it's gorgeous. And we have to turn in all our electronics. We have to turn in our cell phones, our laptops, all of that. So you're going there to unplug. You're going to have a digital detox, they call it. So you go there and you connect as yourself. You're not allowed to go by your full name. You're allowed to go only by a nickname.
Really?
Yep. You're not allowed to talk about your age. So there's no ageism. You're definitely not allowed to talk about what you do at work. So there's none of that. Oh, what do you do? That kind of like sleazy networking situation.
Yeah.
So it's very much, hey, what's your nickname? I went by Buttercup. So they would know me.
Cute.
It was actually because my dog was named Buttercup and he passed away.
Oh no.
He slipped his disc and we got him surgery, but the surgeon messed up and paralyzed him from waist down. So it's like a really sad situation. He was 4 years old only. And
I'm so sorry.
But thank you. He passed away a while ago, but even talking about him till this day, I get very emotional and watery eyed. In honor of Buttercup, I named myself Buttercup at the camp. I just kind of very much like embodied his free spirit. That's what I learned from Buttercup. And I always feel like no matter who or what is in your life, you always can learn something. And I definitely embodied Buttercup free spirit and playfulness throughout the summer. Well, not summer camp. They call it adult summer camp, but it's like only 3 days.
That sounds so much fun.
It was so much fun. And then you end up bonding over play shops. Instead of workshops, they call it play shops. I took classes where you can learn how to dip candles, or other people can learn how to write poetry, or others can learn how to, you know, go rock climbing and stuff like that. So it's so random, like archery and all that. So you do that for 3 days in the woods with no technology and these new people that you're meeting, and they really get to see you as you without all those layers of shit that you build on top as you're getting older, whether insecurities or trying to be somebody else. It's all ripped off once you're there. I love things like that. So I love when I hear about retreats focused for writers. That's amazing. And thank you for sharing that. I would love if I could squeeze in listener questions for you.
Absolutely.
Normally, I do weave in questions about writing processes and stuff like that. But I think that they did a very good job themselves. So I'll just let them ask what they want to know. So Jean Rodrigue from our group, she said, you write YA and romance novels. Both genres, unfortunately and wrongly, are treated as lesser literature. And she says it's complete BS. And what she'd like to know is if you have ever had to face this sort of comment. And if you have, what do you tell yourself to remind yourself that you are just as much of an author as any other author?
It's funny that you say that because I feel like, hold on a second. Sorry.
Hey, bro.
Right there. Sorry, guys. I apologize. My little brother knocking on my door because he needs a notepad. Here you go.
Oh, it's so cute. Hi, bro. Bye, bro. Go on with your sexy ass name of your band.
No. Okay. I will tell him you said that. Okay. So I have been told before. It was actually a friend during my first launch party for The Vicious Deep. He said, oh, congratulations. Then he asked me, when are you going to write a real book?
Whoa.
And I was like, listen, my book is actually printed and yours is still in your computer. It's not even half written. It's really frustrating because you want to be supportive of all of your friends, but you can't support people who look down on you. I've learned that over the years. I don't really go to a lot of highbrow literary events because I feel like as soon as I say YA or romance, you get this look. And I think that as long as you're secure in yourself and in your own writing, I'm incredibly proud of the books that I've written because I write about kids that are complicated. My main character, Tristan, was a complicated character. He's a bro-y douchebag. And I had to take this unfinished boy and turn him into a hero. And so that was my journey. And then for Alex, I had to take this broken girl and make her whole again. And with all of my characters, they're the things that matter when I'm writing. So as long as my readers are okay with it, I'm okay with it. When I go to conferences and when I go to events where people look down on YA, I've been at dinner parties where people are making fun of romance. And I just get so mad. My rusting witch face will not control itself. I'm honest about, why are you talking about things you don't understand? Like, if you don't read it, why are you talking about it? I get really combative But that's just who I am when it comes to things that I feel really passionate about, because at the end of the day, romance and YA are the two biggest selling genres. The reason people look down on them is because they're helmed by women. If men write romance, it wouldn't be the same thing. It would be a respected genre. That's what I think. When you look at who's these blockbuster romance authors, they're women. Who are the blockbuster YA authors? They're women.
I mean, Nicholas Sparks, no one gives him shit.
Nope, nobody gives him shit because he's a dude writing romance. But everybody rolls their eyes when they're like Danielle Steele or Nora Roberts. And I'm like, so what's the difference? What is the difference? I didn't write my book with a penis pen.
Seriously, it's like scribbling with a tip right there. Ouch. I would think for myself, I would absolutely prefer a female writer to write my romance novels than a man.
Absolutely. I don't understand. But at the end of the day, I'm going to keep writing them and can't tell me nothing.
That's awesome. And it's just crazy to like specifically talking about YA. You're shaping the youth. You're shaping future leaders, our future generation with your stories. And you're adding empathy in their lives. You're letting them understand what it's like to have compassion, to understand about other cultures.
The reason why is, to be honest, people think that writing YA is easier than writing other books. They see it as a lesser form of writing. But at the end of the day, the hardest form of writing is actually middle grade, because kids can tell when you're being phony. Nobody can spot a fake like young people. In literary fiction, okay, you want to describe a carpet for, you know, 10 pages and you want to call it literature, but when you're writing a YA novel and you're A-boring your reader and you're not developing a character, you lose your audience. You have more character-driven stories that can still be beautiful and literary. And if you just look at Nicola Yoon, Anna Marie Macklemore, we have both. We have genre and we have beautiful literary books too. So it's just that nobody wants to see it like that. And I think that we just have to come to a point where we give YA books respect.
I love that. Talking about middle grade book, Sasha Nanua from our group, she asked, will you ever write a middle grade book?
Funny you should say that. It hasn't been announced yet, but I'm writing a middle grade for Scholastic this summer.
Oh my gosh, you're going to be so excited. Thank you for sharing that. I'm honored. That is awesome.
So you guys get to hear it first. We just got our contracts in, so I was just waiting for the contracts to come in. We'll probably announce it sometime in July as well, but if it goes through you guys first, it's totally 100% okay. So I'm writing a middle grade and it's a Scholastic. I can't say what it's about yet, but it comes out in spring 2019. So there's still a little bit of a wait, but it'll be amazing.
I'm so excited for you. Congratulations yet again. Yeah. Good news upon good news. That's so freaking exciting. Good for you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And Zaret, we have Catherine Locke. She said, I think she might be friends with you because she made like this tongue face with the emoji.
What did she say?
She wrote, Zoraida is the best. And then she put like the cute emoji face, like sticking the tongue out. I'm like, okay, that sounds like she probably knows Zoraida and is friends with her.
Yeah.
So she said she'd love to know if the Alice in Wonderland comparison came from you or from your publisher. And if it came from you, if you used that deliberately or went back to that text at all.
Originally, I had pitched this as a Guillermo del Toro Alice in Wonderland. And I didn't reread Alice because I wanted it to be completely fresh in my mind, everything that I was creating. But I'm rereading Alice now for my middle grade.
Nice. Okay.
And it's just because I'm a big fan of portal fantasies and going through the looking glass, going through the wardrobe, going through a portal. Like, I just love that kind of magic. And also the idea of being in a world where nothing is familiar. And in a lot of ways, that is the immigrant story, because nothing is familiar when you come to a new country and you have to figure out how to survive. But if you take that to a magical level, you're trying to survive, the stakes are a lot different. I love Alice in Wonderland. It's one of my favorites.
Talking about with my mom and dad, they definitely came as immigrants. And even for me being born here, my first language was Chinese. And then I had to be sent to ESL because my grandma was the one helping to raise me while my mom and dad were working really hard and just making sure to put food on the table. What was that like for you for adapting to the English language? Because for me, I had to take ESL till I think I was 6 or 5 years old. And then I completely forgot Chinese because I was so embarrassed about it because people gave me so much shit and really bullied me. And then I ended up forgetting Chinese. I'm ashamed to say it now, but I almost wanted to walk away from my culture just to be accepted easier and just to kind of have people back off. But now I'm very much like, I really want to learn Chinese. I've picked it back up. I don't know how. I think it just like allowed myself to want to learn. Yeah. It's like, it's crazy how your brain just blocks shit out.
Well, I felt a similar way about Spanish. I was in ESL until the fifth grade. And in the fifth grade, I placed out of it because my English was better than my Spanish at that point. I got to the point also where I just didn't want to speak Spanish. When I was in high school, I didn't want to speak Spanish because like the girls would make fun of me and they would call me slur words for Spanish. And that's in New York. You know what I mean?
Oh,
but it's just no matter where you go, there's just like, within communities, within POC communities, there's always going to be some sort of conflict. And I think
unfortunately,
that, like,
and not right.
Yeah. When I speak Spanish, I speak Spanish with an accent. But when I'm around more Spanish people, I spend a lot of time in Puerto Rico once a year. And when I'm there, I feel like my Spanish gets a lot better.
Yeah, because you're picking it up. You're practicing. I think that's like my Chinese. My girlfriend, she's Taiwanese. And when her mom comes and visits us, the mom visits us from Taiwan. So I basically only communicate to her mom in Chinese. So my Chinese improves a lot. But then within that short time frame that the mom visits. And then when she's not visiting, suddenly my Chinese is so bad. But I'm so sorry to hear that, the racial slur words. I understand about you saying, like, can you believe it's New York? But it's just shocking because you would think in New York, being so diverse, that we wouldn't come across that.
What part of New York did you grow up in?
So I was born in the city, lived a little bit in Flushing, Queens, and then my mom...
Oh my God, I got my belly button pierced in Flushing, Queens.
I did too! Wait, did you go to one of those Busy Bee malls?
I don't remember. It was like on the last stop of the 7 train. No, it was the Q17. They definitely did not card us. You're supposed to be 18, but we were 16, and he was just like, whatever.
I did not even know they were supposed to card you because they didn't card me either.
That's so funny. We might have gotten our belly button pierced in the same place.
Where in Queens were you from?
I was from Hollis in Jamaica. It's from the Run DMC song. It's Christmas time.
Oh my God, yes. Okay, yes. That is amazing. I love that. You want to finish the rest?
No.
Better not have me chiming. I'm going to move on to the next question. So Megan LaCroix.
Hi, Megan.
Aw. She said, eek. Like, she's very excited. I don't know if I said it like in the right tone. She said she's so excited to hear that you're on the podcast. She said that you mentioned that Labyrinth Lost went through a few serious edits, and she would love to know how different the final version is from the first.
It is a completely different novel than the first novel. And the reason why, when I outlined it the first time, there was no Los Lagos. They didn't even go to the next realm. Alex was with Rishi and Nova. It was more of a journey within Brooklyn, but I had realized that I just did this with the Vicious Deep, where they search for things within the city. And then they kept talking about this other world. And so that's when I realized they should just fucking go to this other world. We have to see it. It can't just allude to something and not show it on the page, I think. It's bad teasing. And so as I was developing Los Lagos, I got really carried away in the amount of things that needed to happen. There was another subplot. There were three plots going on at the same time.
Oh, dang.
And it was just this idea of, I wanted to do too much in one story. We cut out a huge chunk of some of the middle when they're traversing through the lands. And so I cut out two civilizations. They're still in the world and they're referred to on the maps, but they don't exist in the actual story. With doing that, I freed up so much more of Alex's story, because at the end of the day, I kept losing her. I kept losing who she was, and that the story is intrinsically about her and her journey and her family. And I got really carried away and like, wouldn't this be cool if there was this society? It was excess. It was partially, it was like fear of delving too much into your character. You know, like when it gets real, once I cut out all of that stuff, which were my editor's notes, then it was more streamlined. And then we really figured it out.
How many words approximately, if you can remember, did you have to lose and say goodbye to?
So I think we lost 20,000. I rewrote a big part of it.
How was that like for you to lose that? Were you okay parting ways with it?
It was a struggle, just because I don't like being wrong. I knew my editor was right. I just didn't want her to be right.
You didn't want to let her know that she was right.
But she's great.
Fair enough. For me, I'm just like, oh shit, I do not want to get rid of those words that I just spewed out.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Like,
I know. Hell no. It's hard. I think letting go is such a big thing. But I really like that question, so thank you.
I was just thinking, damn, this is such great practice. If anyone plans to have kids, it's just to like write this novel and cut out like 50,000 words. And it's like, you just understand when you have teenagers, all that time and effort goes into raising them right, but they talk back to you. It's like, what? Okay, so Alexandria Sturtz asked, what parts of your life inspired Labyrinth Lost?
Some of the superstition things, like when you drop a fork, it means you're had to have company. I changed it a little bit. And so I gave something to the spoon, the fork, and the knife. And that's if you drop it, that means you're having company. But what kind of company? Mostly just like the family celebrations, because the biggest thing that I wanted to do with Labyrinth Lost is create a whole new religion. This religion is for the witches. Creating this mythology was so much fun for me because I use the structure of the Greek gods. I anthropomorphize emotions and I turn them into gods. So the gods are just living emotions, things that you would pray to. Do you pray to your fear? Do you pray to the darkness? Do you pray to like love? There's a lot of the Catholicism that I grew up with, but also the magic that I wish also existed.
That's beautiful.
Thanks. When creating religions is really difficult because you don't want to take any practices that already exist. But at the same time, there are a lot of familiarities with the structure. I had a really good time doing that just because mythology is my favorite part of world building when it comes to fantasy.
That's the thing I think is incredible, where I think I remember reading somewhere where you made up the mythology. You know, you would think usually reading this, it's like, oh, maybe it's something you grew up with.
And I think that has been the reception, because people are like, so-and-so Latin American mythology. There is no Latin American mythology, because it's like saying there's African mythology. There's so many different countries, and Latin America is wildly Catholic. We don't have myth the way that the Norse and the Celt, and they have myth. We have conquest and we have colonization. And so that all shaped the way that I wanted to build this religion. I think a lot of people just assume, because in most contemporary American things, you have these brujas and these witches, and that's the representation of Latinos. And so everybody thinks that the stuff that is in my books is actually a real religion, and it isn't.
Also a huge nod to you, because you wrote it so well, where people were like, oh my gosh, it's probably inspired by something real. I was like, wow, okay, that's really in-depth world building. How did you keep yourself organized?
I keep a box for all of my stories, at least a file. Like, they're not really folders, but they're stand-up boxes.
Yes, yes. And you could put the dates of months and stuff like that to separate it, like the accordion.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of like that. And then I have these other boxes where I keep per book. And so I have notebooks dedicated specifically for a single book. When I'm mapping, I use those architect graph papers, the big, big ones that like supposed to cover a whole table. I use those. It's just giant graph paper. I like the lines because I also write crooked. I like this graph paper because it keeps me organized, even though when you look at it, it's just chaos. And so I do my beats on this giant thing. And then I move to index cards as well. I just combine everything. I rewrite a lot of my outlines over and over again, because I feel like I need to refresh myself as what's happening. And if I keep thinking about it and keep thinking about it and just keep rewriting it, it's like pulling on a motor and like you're just revving yourself up to get to the point where you can actually write the scene. So if I keep writing to myself what the scene is about, well, this scene is about this. And if I rewrite it, and then finally I can write the actual scene.
That was awesome. Thank you for bringing us behind the scenes. I appreciate it. I felt like I was able to imagine it as you were describing it. I love this question from Tina Crossgrove. I think is a great way to wrap up the listener questions. She said, first of all, she loved Labyrinth Lost. She loved the novel.
Thank you.
And she'd love to know, what was the most difficult or challenging aspect of creating or writing the story? And what steps did you take to overcome this difficulty?
The most difficult part about writing Labyrinth Lost is getting inside Alex's head, because Alex is the kind of person who was very dark. And coming from having just written a trilogy about a boy who shirks responsibility and is very light, her mind was very dark for me. I think that I internalized a lot of the way that we see girls in books and how we brush them off as being unlikable, because those are a lot of the notes that I kept getting. And like, Alex is unlikable. She whines, but she doesn't whine. She had a dead body fall on her when she was 7 years old. She lost her dad. He just vanished. Her power awoke and she didn't know what to do with it. So I think that I kept giving her reasons to rationalize her mood And I feel that was an injustice to her because she didn't need so many reasons. But at the same time, I had to work with an audience who is harder on girls than they are on men. And so working with Alex and doing justice to her character was the hardest part. And the way that I did that was by giving her a happy ending. Originally, she was gonna not have a relationship. It was gonna be a do me kind of thing. But at the same time, I feel like she deserves somebody who loves her and who she loves back without any reservation and who can make her happy without judgment. And the person that she chooses is the person that is the most right for her. I think that was my thing.
Thank you for sharing that. Usually with that, how do you realize when you are happy with your ending and the choices that you made?
It's just a feeling of being complete. I know when I don't want to rewrite that ending scene, because when I keep wanting to rewrite it, I think that I know that there's something missing. But when I don't want to rewrite it, that's how I know I'm finished.
But so intuition. Okay, very cool. Mm-hmm. Sarada, that was amazing. Thank you so much. If we could wrap it up with you choose whether you want to share any advice for writers or your favorite books that you would advise them to read.
One of the best books that I've read this year, there are two actually. It's Flame in the Mist by Renee Adier. That story just completely blew me over. And The Forest of 1,000 Lanterns. I read that. And that's an arc and that's coming out in October. And that book was amazing. Both of these are fantasies and both of these are East Asian fantasies. They're just really fantastic. Also, I'm currently reading The Bell by Danielle Clayton. And it is such a discussion about beauty and the fucked up things that we do for beauty. And I think it's a really important conversation to have. That's another book that I really, really love. But for the writers, I think that my biggest advice is to read widely, read fiction, read nonfiction, read poetry, read whatever you can get your hands on, just because it shapes your voice. It shapes the way that you see your characters. It helps you figure out who you are as a writer and how you want to tell your stories. It sounds kitschy, but it's number one. One of the things that the only downside to being on deadline literally every single month this year is not being able to read as much.
I do know that almost every author has also mentioned that reading is a crucial part in improving yourself and growing yourself as a writer. Mm-hmm. It's true. Like if you want to be one of the greats, you got to learn from the greats. So
absolutely.
It's definitely a much needed advice that people need reminders for. Whatever your pace, even if that means taking in audiobooks, keep devouring the content and the material because you're going to grow yourself. You're going to exercise that muscle in a way that you can't otherwise without reading. Thank you for that, Sarada. You have been awesome.
Thank you. Thank you everybody for your questions too.
I'm so excited to catch up and see all your photos that you're going to start posting for your trip. I'm very, very pumped for that.
On Instagram, I am Zoraida Solo. Zoraida, like, this is my first name and then Han Solo's last name.
Oh my God, I love that. Awesome. And are you going to be tweeting as well or are you going to be sticking to Instagram for the hype?
I think I'm going to stick to Instagram just to reserve battery life and then I feed it into Twitter.
Smart. Okay, done and done. We'll find you on Instagram.
All right, I'll talk to you later. Bye.
And that wraps up our episode with Zoraida Cordova. Zoraida, I had such a fun time chatting with you, and I can't wait for our community to check out your hiking photos on Instagram. Storytellers, I hope you all had as much fun listening to Zoraida's episode. As always, I am so grateful for your support, and thank you so much for hanging out with us each and every week. Please say hi to Zoraida on Twitter at ZLikeInZorro, and head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Zoraida Cordova. At the top of the show, I talked about Overdrive and their new app, Libby. I've been a fan of Overdrive for 6 years. I first discovered them when I moved into my own place for the first time ever and needed a positive distraction after a breakup. The library down the block from me had these pamphlets about Overdrive that explained how to borrow ebooks and audiobooks with my library card. I was obsessed and started borrowing audiobooks back to back, starting off with some self-help books to give me a boost during the breakup. Fast forward 6 years, I am super happy and have grown a lot as a person, and it's awesome to see that Overdrive has gone the same direction in terms of growth and expansion, and now has Libby, their brand new app they built with a lot of love. The app was designed to get people reading as quickly and seamlessly as possible, and this was all inspired by user and library feedback. So think of Libby like a librarian in your pocket. She's a one-tap reading app from your library and Overdrive. While millions of people around the world use their library to read books every day with Overdrive, half of the United States alone doesn't have a library card. Overdrive wants to change that with Libby. Libby has also been designed to recommend awesome books to read next. I could not be more proud to collaborate with a team that exists to spread literacy, reading, and libraries. Be sure to download Libby on your phone or tablet and rediscover the magic of libraries. Head over to meet.libbyapp.com. And don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other listeners from our show at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I can't wait to meet you in there. That's facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.